Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I am your host, Radu Palamariu, Managing Director of Elkott Global. And it's my pleasure to have with us today Konrad Bauer, who is the VP Supply Chain and Operations at Thermo Fisher Scientific. Thermo Fisher Scientific is the global leader in providing equipment, software, services, and consumables to help scientists solve problems across a multitude of fields, from pharmaceutical to biotechnology, from academia to government, from environmental to industrial research, as well as clinical laboratory. With a revenue of more than $25 billion, Thermo Fisher is the leader in the field, and Konrad, obviously overseeing at the global level the supply chain and operations side, has a lot of interesting stories to share with us. So it's my pleasure to welcome you, and thanks for making the time to join us today, Konrad.
Thank you, Radu. Happy to be here.
And first and foremost, I wanted to start with your personal journey in the realm of supply chain, because I know your career is a very interesting one. You started in Dutz, which is a German motor manufacturer, and then you transitioned and spent 10 years at McKinsey. And subsequently, you moved to Bayern in a global role, and now you're part of Thermo Fisher. So I'd like to ask you a little bit to tell us how this kind of came about, and specifically, I want to ask you on the move to consulting and from consulting, which a lot of people on the podcast and usually in real life ask us, you know, how to best navigate. So tell us a little bit more.
Thanks. Yeah. So if I think about the first move, that's basically from a, if you want to say like that, a normal job into the consulting arena. That was more the opportunity. Actually, when I finished university and the internet bubble bursted, it was not that easy to find jobs. So I started in one of the old-fashioned industries, if you want also. I guess many of my former colleagues will now say, well, engine manufacturing is not that old-fashioned after all. At a certain point where I had decided that I need to move on, I actually got headhunted by McKinsey and moved into McKinsey in 2007, 2008, and started my job as a consultant. Now, that move is not that easy as many people think. When I left Deutz, I already managed my first team. I had some experience. You were known for something. And then you come in and you start as a consultant at a team. It is quite a learning to have a lot of people giving you feedback and input to what you're actually doing in your day-to-day work, which you have not been used to in your past. I would also say, I'm actually not sure if the 2008 crisis would not have existed if I would have sustained, because I felt the first 6 months being a consultant very painful. It was like going from you do meetings where you have to take decisions to you do concepts and draw charts. And there's something in there which is at that first step very frightening for you when you come out of such a standard job. Now, I have stayed 7 to 7.5 years, not 10. And I think the value you actually can take out of it if you're ever coming into a consultancy is just there's nowhere where you can see so many different topics where you can actually learn in such a speed on how to manage different situations, how to communicate, how to structure your thinking, how to structure your logic. And there's not any other place where you can meet so many people, interesting people in such a fast speed. It's kind of a speed dating with the modus operandi that you do projects over and over. The second move then out was more, there was this urge in me to say, hey, this is all great, and I've worked internationally, etc. But I really want to see something through again. I really want to go back into a job where I can decide something, where I can drive my own decisions, drive my own team, and make things happen. And that was the decision when I decided to leave McKinsey. The challenge then becomes, what is the right exit position? And I think one of the best advices my first boss at Deutz gave me is like, you know, you never should leave something because you want to leave. You always should leave because you want to go somewhere. So for me, it was clear to decide where do I want to go. And the where to was, okay, if I want to do something where I can implement things, where I can lead my own teams, it needs to be an operational role. It needs to be in a line management function again. And it needs to be kind of in a situation where I get some degrees of freedom and not just be the administrator. And I think that's what I found when Bayer offered me a job to take over the consumer health supply chain, because at that time they were restructuring and rebuilding that supply chain function. And if you ask me what was the hardest there in the first six months, I think it is just a step back. It is a step back of the consulting times is very good in getting rid of you from any day-to-day administrative work or whatsoever, because that's all taken care of for you. And getting used to that actually 60% of your daily life is repetitive task, has to do with not so much administrative, but just with repetitive performance management and other topics, is quite a change which you have to sustain, and where you only recognize how much different your life as a consultant has been, where mainly 80% of your time is doing something new, creating value for a client. That is where the biggest change is. What has driven me was this drive to say, I want to do something by myself and I want to see it through. And that's what kept me on board to basically stay in the industry and then change.
No, that's fascinating. And thanks for sharing the journey, because in my personal view, and I've had heard this from several executives, to your point, consulting can be an excellent career accelerator in terms of that opportunity to experience, see, and almost, you know, fast track. It's almost like learning on steroids, because you get to experience so many different organizations and models and ways of doing business, and you kind of get a chance to learn very fast. And at the same time, you know, sometimes that transition that you manage to make back into the industry is not always easy. So I think that, you know, your example and also the challenges that you faced are excellent sharing in terms of, you know, what people can kind of expect. Moving to Thermo Fisher, I wanted to discuss a little bit from a supply chain perspective, because you're probably, you know, one of the companies that, I mean, one, you have tens of thousands of SKUs of highly sophisticated equipment. It's quite a complex type of supply chain. So I want to start by asking you, in this type of an environment, what are some of the main challenges that you have when it comes to managing supply chain and operations in such complexity and basically in such a complex environment?
I think if I look at it, there's the most evident one at the moment, Radu, which is the COVID crisis. And if I take that, this is all about how do you organize how first of all do you predict demand, which I think is a challenge by itself. And we should talk about if you actually want to predict demand or if you just work on a few scenarios. And then the second one out of the current crisis is how stable is your supply landscape? With the shutdowns, et cetera, like it's the first pandemic which ever entered manufacturing sites at big scale. So your resilience program, your supply chain resilience and everything has been put to great tests. And I think everybody of us learned that whatever we predicted was not right, correct? Everybody has these pandemic plans in their drawers for business continuity reasons. But if you then look at it, how it really unfolded, how it really traveled, that's very different. So I think that's, if I think about disruption, was the biggest disruption in the last 9 months on what is the demand really looking like and how do I stabilize my supply given all the constraints, and also given constraints which I think nobody had in their pandemic plans. Like nobody of us thought about that airlines would ground most of their passenger freight flights and visit one and all of the belly freight. I think there's just blank spots which we didn't see through. The more global situation, if I take pre-pandemic, is we have all been brought up in the last years, and at least I can say that for myself, in a world of free movement of kind of anything, right? It was always about free trade. It was always about free movement across borders and how to facilitate that and how to make it easier and how to automate it more. And I think what the past has shown us, that one got more difficult. So our thinking needs to shift in that sense as well, from can I still live with a global center of excellence, even if it's small volume, or do I even for small volumes need to have kind of a dual sourcing approach just to be prepared for some of the disruptions which happened before and during the COVID crisis?
And what would be some of the, since we're, and I was kind of, I didn't want to ask you first and foremost with COVID. I didn't want to put that in the first question, but it's the obvious elephant in the room. So I wanted to go further on your point and ask, what are some of the major changes that you have made in the last 6-9 months, I guess, around your supply chain and operations, and you've had to put in place to make sure that you maintain, well, the supply chain working well, given all these disruptions and all these unplanned and unforeseen consequences of a global pandemic?
So the first one, Radu, is the obvious in the sense of we increased our inventories, and we did so when the pandemic started in China at that time point. So we started with a, I don't know how you want to call it, if you want to call it a war room or just an alignment session, whatever, but we started with a central steering on looking at China, which of our suppliers can deliver, which can't deliver. And then during the shutdown period in China, pinging our suppliers on, hey, when are you going to come back? Do you have enough raw materials? Are your people really going to come back? You had to go very deep with your partners into how big is the risk, and you had to be very clear on prioritization. What do you really want out of it? Because what you needed to avoid is a typical hockey stick effect of planners, which then would say, well, I need everything. No, you actually need to do trade-offs. If a supplier tells you, hey, I only will have 40% of my workforce coming back, you need to say, okay, if he has only 40% of the workforce and he's one of our major suppliers, we need to be crystal clear what we need first and what we need after that. And that's what we kind of did it in speed learning during this first part of the crisis in China. So I would say January, February gave us that experience of how do you prioritize, how to be extremely smart about what you need, and how deep do you have to go with your suppliers. And in February, March, the crisis widened their scope, right? So you knew that processes, I would say, you trained for supply in China and you started to roll out. So the first rollout was Northern Italy. Northern Italy, I think by now everybody knows in the diagnostic space, is very interesting, for example, because one of the biggest suppliers of swabs is sitting there and other suppliers. So you kind of did the same approach, but then you came to a halt. And what I mean by that is the complexity was just too big. If you think about it, we have tens of thousands finished goods SKUs. We have more of that on raw materials. There's a limit if you think about the capability on the time your planners have to manage all these suppliers, all these supply chains on a bit by bit, and also always figuring out how this crisis moves on. Because it was like, it was Italy, then it was Germany, France. So at that point, actually, when it started to spread into Europe, we changed our gear completely. And instead of doing it focus, we just increased our inventories across the board. Despite assuming that some of our demand went down, that's what we did, just to be, it's more about how do you do the bold move to stay reliable for the healthcare system and for your customers, then how do you do the right move, which obviously academically we would all look for, but you just come to face reality. It's not going to work in the dynamic which is going around. Maybe at some point we're going to have systems and calculation power to just calculate this all perfectly, but my reality is at the moment we don't. So that's what we did on the supply side. If I switch gear to the demand side, this was all about scenario planning. I mean, you have to go in with the mindset of most likely your demand plan is wrong, but you need a number. And I think you have to get everybody to that mindset of, now, we're not going to chase forecast accuracy. We're not going to chase forecast bias. Let's chase what is actually the right number to serve our customers, to serve the markets. And let's have in the back of our mind the trade-off on what would we really lose if this number is too high, or what would we really lose if it's too low? And I would say in our segment in healthcare, the tendency is rather you better go too high because you don't want to strain a healthcare system in such a pandemic crisis. So what we did, we did the same thing as everybody. We talked about the V, the W, and whatever shape. We built scenarios, but we also pre-produced, assuming there is is basically a ramp up in the third and the fourth quarter. But we kept our demand willingly higher for the prior quarters just to keep the supply chains flowing and just to keep managing the disruptions which come in between. And then a third part for us, obviously, is everything which is COVID-related materials, where at a certain point, with the demand increases we've seen, we just basically added a lot of demand and moved fast on capacity expansion projects and investments to make sure we can supply the market. Mm. If you ask me systematically what it needs in your supply chain, I think it's the usual things which make supply chain good. You need fast decisions and you need decisions on incomplete data sets. That's what you really need to train people to say, you need to be fast, you need to do it on an incomplete data set and keep your major trade-off in mind. And your major trade-off is you need to serve your customer and the healthcare system, rather do we just talk about stranded costs, which is going to be a carryover over time, or do we take about real money, which could threaten the company? Hmm.
And I have a specific question that came from one of our audience on this topic of, you know, serving the client and making sure that the client, and especially in industries like yours, where it's literally life and death in certain situations, is critical. At the same time, it can come at a cost. And especially in this pandemic, the cost for logistics specifically went up significantly, depending on, you know, on where you were. So the question was, did you manage to pass some of these costs or logistics costs that went up to the client? Or what was your way around this particular challenge that came up?
So I think on the logistics cost, it's clear, correct? Our air freight rates at the beginning of the pandemic and during the pandemic basically increased to 6 to 10 times what you have seen beforehand. I think it's part, correct? Partially, you're able to pass such costs on. Partially, you're absorbing it. And it's a little bit the question of the product structure behind it. So if you think about the products which were very important for us, Radu, if you take about a test kit, we talk about a lot of reagents and things like that. So while the cost factor transport went up 6 times, if I take it as percentage of my total cost, it's not the driver of the total cost of my product, correct? Mm-hmm. So I think this one from an answer for us was not such a huge pain point. It is a pain point, I'm admitting that. It is a cost challenge. But if I would think about other industries I work for, I would say for them it's much more of a pain because logistics cost is actually a higher part of the total cost. Mm. Does it make sense to you? For us, it's just, if you're in our business, your transportation cost is kind of 2 to 3% of your overall COGS. Mm. So yes, it hurts, but it's not that dramatic. Let's put it that way.
Understood. And it makes sense. I mean, it definitely would be different for a faster moving industry like FMCG or something like that.
And I think then the second one on that, rather, it's also a strategic discussion. Do you want to try to increase prices in a time where your demand is uncertain? Mm. Or do you weather it? So I would also say our strategy has always been like, we first of all try to serve our customers, and then depending on how strong or weak demand is, you can drive those decisions. But don't forget this. Mm. It's not that easy, I think, in such a time of uncertainty to just pass on pricing. But I'm not a commercial guy at the end. So for us, it wasn't such a big topic.
Understood. And also when it comes to having so many different products and SKUs and also Thermo Fisher, you have different lines and different business units. The question that came out is, how do you also manage to maintain consistency in such a complex business and across your many different products and many different business units? Even possible.
Exactly. It's a good question. It's a question we ask ourselves. So I think we are if I take the continuum on that, you have companies which are extremely, at our size and complexity, which are extremely central managed, and you have on the other part of the continuum companies which are more decentralized. I think we are on this decentralized level. You need actually to ask yourself on how much consistency do you need to be successful, and where does it make sense and where not. People who know me also as one, I'm not a big believer in you harmonize and standardize your ERP system to the last bone. What I think is you need a good data model behind it, and you should actually think about the data-driven supply chain more than about the processual or supply chain. And I think that's where the difference is, Radu. So what is the value of standardization and consistency? And where do I have the biggest value and how do I drive that? So let me give you an example. Would we start a huge effort to have all the transactional systems in our 180 plus sites harmonized? No. Do we invest efforts in creating one data model so you can have a consistent steering and you have actually a data-driven supply chain? Yes. And I think that's what it's for me all about, is digitization, automation, and all these buzzwords flying around. If you think about them in supply chain, they give you the one thing. Data doesn't cost a lot anymore to be stored. So if you start to build a data consistency in kind of a, I don't know how you want to call it, database, data lake, or whatever, and most likely people are not even clear where the distinction is between these words, I think that's where you really can drive consistency, and that's how you do it. So my thinking is more have one data model and data structure which is consistent, in which you can plug and play different solutions so you don't have to reinvent the wheel in the company. Now, here's the other truth to that. If you look at our company, we have very different businesses. We have large equipments, we have small equipments, we have consumables, we have chemicals. So everybody who is working in supply chain also knows that this is not going to be a one size fits all. So my consistency is more have a level one or two approach at the same structure and the same level. But below that, you need to differentiate anyhow, because consumables can be promotion driven. Some of our equipments, which costs quite a lot and are more investments for universities, et cetera, are not as much promotion driven. They're much more driven by investment decisions, budget decisions, and other topics. So I think, I know it's not a straightforward answer like here's your golden bullet to consistency, but I think what you need to do is to A, think through where does the consistency drive value and what do you need out of it? So it's again, what is your trade-off? B, what is actually modern technology offering you? And then C, you create a plan out of there where to build consistency and how to do it, instead of just saying standardization for the sake of standardization, because that has not proven to be a good business decision in the past and still not.
Mm. No, thanks for keeping it real. And I would tend to agree with your comments. And also on the digital front, I guess a lot of these initiatives, and I can't remember the exact numbers, but there's billions every year spent and wasted because people don't think through why are we doing what we're doing in the first place, beyond the buzzword or beyond the impression that it's a good idea, but you end up spending a lot of money and time and you don't solve anything, so because you don't actually solve a problem that is existing in the company in reality. On that point with digital or automation or AI or machine learning or God knows, you know, I don't want to go into the buzzwords, but I'm just wondering if you might have seen, right, there was this kind of half joke, half truth that COVID-19 has accelerated by far the most the digital transformation of all companies. Have you, in Thermo Fisher, implemented some new projects, or did you embark on some any new initiatives that you've managed to kind of see through, even if it's a fairly short duration, right? 6 months, 6 to 8 months now that we are in this pandemic, that are kind of in this realm of supply chain digital transformation, I guess.
So I guess the first one is we have all proven that you can actually plan a factory without being at site. And I'm saying that so bluntly, it's like it's a work from home topic, but it has also something to do with the belief of many people of I can only plan production when I have people at site, etc. So I think from a learning, COVID has shown, or not COVID itself, but the pressure to have less people at site and to do much more remote has shown us that we are actually able to do some of these things remote, which in the past, if you think about the challenges to build supply chain, shared services, etc., have come up, you might now say the myth is finally busted for most of the companies. If it comes to ourselves, we're thinking that through at the moment. Rather, the reality is, if I look at the supply chains, because we're part of fighting COVID from a test perspective and other topics, our focus has been really on delivering more than it has been of what are the final learnings we're taking for digitization of the supply chain. It's going to come. And as I said, my thinking at the moment is it has proven us a few points where people would beforehand have said, like, this is never feasible. What are we going to finally do out of it? We're still mulling that through.
And specifically on the topic of, there's been all sorts of discussions now that this pandemic is going to lead from a globalization in a global world to a regionalization of supply chain and making it much more or bringing them closer to markets and distribution, places of distribution and so on. Have you seen a shift and is Thermo Fisher doing anything to recalibrate or rearrange or, you know, even move some manufacturing from certain parts of the world to other parts of the world? Or is it still kind of a wait and see a little bit for you guys? What's the situation?
So I think the shift is difficult, correct? I'm going to give you a twofold answer. The one is there's a shift in thinking. People are starting to have a very different reflection on this point where it's even for smaller volumes, you're kind of getting into the camp of, if it's a small volume, is it sufficient to have manufacturing and knowledge in one region, or do I need to have it at least in two regions worldwide? And then the question is, how do you balance regions against each other? Like, because this is not only COVID, this has to do with trade disruptions at the moment and so many other things. But I think we all come to, from a thinking perspective, to the point that free flow and free trade is getting harder, and we need to build a different resilience against that than we have done before. Now, if it comes to executing on that, it's a lot harder to think that through. So we're thinking that through at the moment, and we're continuously doing that. We're always evaluating what the right network is and how the network should be structured, but it's going to be a, let's say, new flavor to network design on how do you make sure that in case one of your regions, let's call it, is locked down, you still have supply. And what does that mean? Because if you think about second sourcing, etc., it sounds so easy. There's a huge cost impact in it. And there's also an impact in it of how do you keep your sites fit to run? Because just because you have a product certified at a second site, doesn't mean like 2 years down the road that they're still capable of producing it if you're not assuring that the site is over and over producing it, because there's a muscle you need to teach a site and a supply chain to make sure this is happening. So in a summary, yes, it's changing our mindset. No, not yet for execution, but I think it's going to be for consideration going forward.
And I have two more questions for you. And one specifically is for the talent side. And you mentioned also with the piece with the, everybody realizing that you can do a lot of things remotely, including for manufacturing plants and so on. Do you see a shift? Is this a possibility? And I was talking recently with somebody that and he was making the argument that there's going to be a lot of outsourcing of supply chain talent, whether it's going to be on the planning side or supply chain side, or I don't know, logistics side, rather than you have, you know, people in more expensive centers, and I'm just going to name some random locations like Singapore is on London or New York or whatever, you can maybe have them somewhere else and build this kind of knowledge and expertise centers that would be remote. Do you see that happening more? Because now, you know, COVID has kind of shown people that it can be done remotely, or what's your perspective?
I think even before COVID that happened more, correct?
Yes.
Now, there's two thoughts for me very fast in that, Radu. The one is consumer goods companies have shown us that these planning hubs are working, correct? So some of the FMCG companies, as we all know, the big names around that, have done these planning hubs and basically shown us that it can work and that you can have them in lower cost regions and lower cost countries. And I also, before I left Bayer, we started such a project at that time. So I think that one is feasible and is happening. And the second thought with that one is just, you need to be sure on what you actually want to outsource. So if I take the digitization, I still remember that when I was once in a workshop for digitization and somebody stood up and it was a whole management, like it was an operations conference kind of, and somebody stood up just to tell everybody, the people who are working in supply chain and planning, you're the first one digitization will get rid of. That was a nice thesis in the room. Now, if you think about it, and that's why I'm bringing that topic up, I assume in the next 5 to 10 years, the planning behavior is going to change dramatically. So if you're going to change from today's planning, where a lot of people try to outsmart systems in using Excel. Secondly, they're very much still involved in the transactional task, that you kind of come to a model where this is finally solved. I mean, some ERP systems tried to do that before, but they kind of did not get there due to the black box effect. But let's assume this is going to get solved. Then you need a very different talent, correct? So your planner of the future is not a planner which does 70 to 80% of his work in executing transactions and chasing them up. But I think he's more going to be a planner who does 60% of his work in overseeing the system, and if the system works right and has his alerts to see if something gets out of sync. Now, obviously, to get there means you need to scrub your master data, you have to get data transparency, you have to get data consistency to a very different level than most of the companies, including myself here, are operating. But I think, yes, there's going to be a trend to build more planning hubs, but I think the second trend after that is you're going to do higher levels of automation, and the role of the planner is going to change from just transactional to more oversight. And if that's happening, it's actually going to be interesting, Radu, what the dynamic is going to be. Do you then go back to the Singapore, London, etc., because it's just the hotspots where people, the more talented people who are more scarce, are sitting? Or will you make it and actually achieve that you can develop your existing planners into those roles? I can't lay you my crystal ball on that. I actually don't know. I think you have to be open for both of that could happen. There's also another element for me is, what is actually the journey going to be? Is the journey really that you're first going to do the planning hubs and then you're going to automate? Or do you just leapfrog, you automate, and afterwards maybe your business case to go for a planning hub is not existing any longer? If you take some of the automation which is happening in supply chain, and I've worked on some of those projects, if you see that you can take out 30 to 40% of planners with automation efforts, and that's actually feasible today with RPAs, and if you get your data sets clean, etc. So you reduce by 30 to 40%, then the business case for outsourcing your planning teams is getting very different and much more difficult. Especially if you take an end-to-end business case and you talk about what does it cost you to repurpose your people at the existing location or to lay them off or whatsoever. So I'm sometimes asking myself, what is going to come first? Is it really the centralization in planning hubs, or is it just the automation and then you drive it out of your automation?
Yeah, I guess the future will tell. And I have a final question for you, Konrad, in terms of an advice for maybe the younger listeners tuning in for the podcast. And you've shared some great nuggets of wisdom in terms of your own career. But looking back, would there be one or two pieces of advice that you would share with them to fast track their careers? You mentioned that very good one that your first boss told you to never leave a job, to always go for a job that excites you, right? Maybe there's one or two other pieces of advice that you could share.
I think the first one is stay curious. I mean, I've seen too many people in my life who want to make a career and then they always complain that the company doesn't give and the company doesn't do. When I started with a colleague at Bayer, digital efforts, her mantra, and I really appreciate her saying that, is, hey, everybody can learn everything by YouTube today. So if we talk about digitization and planning behaviors, we should actually tell them to be engaged and learn by YouTube. And the more I've been starting to think about it, and the more you think about it, this is what it is. Like, to change and to be successful, be curious, drive yourself. Don't always expect somebody else to hand you something, because that's not going to happen. For myself, this was about moving out of industry and consultancy. It is very different if you do it, and you just have to do it. And you have not to be afraid of these steps. It's this topic of get out of your comfort zone and do something. The second part of that one, and I have to say that's true for my career, is don't be too obsessed about what is your next step. See, in my career, and that might sound funny, but people always talk about, well, you should know where you want to be in the next 5 years, and this is really things. And I think a lot of people, especially in the younger age, got this wrong, in the sense of they think about, what is my next job title? What should be my job title in 5 years? How big should be my team? I don't know. How important is my business card? And I think my second advice would be really, no, you should think about this 5 year question in a very different way, where you say, what is going to still drive you in 5 years? Where are you actually getting your energy from? Is this from solving problems? Is this from talking to people? Like, be clear on what is really driving, where you get your energy from, because it's going to be a much better advisor to yourself for your next position and for your next job. The second one is also with that one, also make sure you know how much you want to see and what you want to see. Because I've seen people who really did very funneled careers in just one field and never looked outside into a different field. And you need to be clear. That's perfectly fine if this is what your energy gives, but it is not what is driving you. So for me, again, the one thing is, as an advice, go for what you need and not because you want to leave something. Secondly, be open and curious and learn for yourself. The third one is, be clear what is driving your energy and where you take your energy from, because it just lets you make your better decisions on your next step in your career. And I think the fourth one, at the moment we're all learning, be open to change, because nothing is always going to stay forever. I think we just have to get used to the new society is going to change faster than it has in the past.
Oh, that's 1000%. Very good sharing, Konrad. Many thanks for all the good examples and pieces of advice, but also from your own experience. And I think that's what makes it most relevant. Good luck in the next months navigating COVID-19 and whatever else it may bring. And hopefully sooner rather than later, it brings the vaccine that kind of sets us all traveling again and getting businesses kind of back to whatever normal will mean. And again, much, much appreciate your time and joining us today.
Perfect. Thanks a lot, Radis. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to go to www.elcotglobal.com and click the podcast button for all the show notes of the interview. Also, subscribe to our mailing list to get our latest updates first. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes, Spotify or Stitcher, we would appreciate a kind review. 5-star works best to keep us going and our production team happy. And of course, share it with your friends. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me. And if you have any suggestions on what to do and who to invite next, don't hesitate to drop me a note. And if you're looking to hire top executives in supply chain or transform your business, of course, contact us as well to find out how we can help.